Welcome, everyone. This is the Rotary Club of Worldwide Impact, and we're excited to share our mission and the work we do as part of Rotary International with all of you today. My name is Kelly, and I'm your host for today's program. Rotary International is a global network of 1.4 million neighbors, friends, leaders, and problem solvers in more than 46,000 clubs, all united in the common goal of making a positive impact in our communities and worldwide. As a Rotary Club, we approach every conversation as an opportunity to learn and grow together. Our goal is to connect with and hear from fascinating and inspiring speakers, often with a message focused on the power of ideas to change lives and ultimately the world, and bring you a little bit of inspiration that allows you to think about how you can make a difference as well. You may be hearing this on your favorite podcast service, watching it on our YouTube channel, or viewing it on our club's website. If you enjoy the program, please share it with a friend and don't forget to leave a good rating. We really like 5 stars. Now, today we are pleased to have with us Sean Yaffe. Sean was born and raised in Montreal. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Biochemistry from McGill University and a Master of Public Health from Université de Montréal. He graduated medical school from St. George's University School of Medicine, where he had the wonderful opportunity to live on the beautiful island of Grenada in the Caribbean. Sounds amazing right now. And in New York City, he lived there for his clinical rotations. He completed his residency at the Henry Ford Hospital Family Medicine Residency Program in Detroit, Michigan, where he also became a certified HIV specialist with the American Academy of HIV Medicine. He practices broad spectrum family medicine based out of Clinique L'Actuelle with a focus on LGBTQ plus health, HIV, and gender affirming care. He's also the co-founder of the Indigenous Health Center of Geojage, the Mohawk term for Montreal, a recently established center with the mission to provide culturally safe, holistic health services to the Indigenous community living in Montreal. We're delighted to have Sean here with us today to speak about this very topic. So please sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Sean, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Awesome. Thanks, Kelly. Nice to meet everybody. This is my first Rotary meeting in about 4 years, 4 or 5 years. I was a previous Rotary director as well, and was then a Rotary member for the Rotary Club of Metro in New York City when I lived there. And then life got a little bit busy, and I have not been able to join again after that. But I'm excited to be back and to talk about cultural safety and Indigenous health. The large focus of the presentation today is going to really be about cultural safety and giving you kind of more of a cultural context of what it's been like in Canada for the Indigenous community, and the I guess kind of the trials and tribulations and things that have gone on for centuries that have kind of affected the Indigenous community and the way they live their life now, and how that impacts everybody living in Canada and around the world as well. So the first idea is, what is cultural safety? So cultural safety is this idea that started in New Zealand. Basically, it's an environment that is spiritually, socially, and emotionally safe, as well as physically safe for people, where there is no assault, challenge, or denial of their identity, of who they are, and what they need. It is about shared respect, shared meaning, shared knowledge, and experience of learning together. So it's the idea of taking cultural awareness, cultural sensitivity, and cultural competency, terms that you've probably all heard a lot in various jobs, and combining them all together into this idea of cultural safety, and really looking at the person sitting in front of you and kind of acknowledging kind of past, maybe past traumas, acknowledging past issues, and kind of connecting over that, and using that as the way to kind of work forward and in an idea of truth and reconciliation. So this whole idea started in New Zealand in the 1980s. There was a nursing group that developed it, and then it made its way to Canada in the early 2000s. Now we're seeing it a lot more, specifically more in the medical field and medical services. But this can really be applied to any area where you're working more with an Indigenous community, and it can also go beyond Indigenous communities. It can go with any kind of vulnerable community or any kind of minority that is in the area where you live. So, kind of looking back, so Canadian history has had a lot of different acts and a lot of things that have happened that have affected the Indigenous community over time. And I won't go into too much detail because you don't have enough time to start day by day from 1763. But really, in 1763 was the first document that recognized indigenous rights by the crown. And that's where things started changing in terms of how land was used and what was reserved for indigenous people and what wasn't, and what could be sold and what could not be sold on different land. And then in 1867 is when there was the development of the British North American Act, which defined Indian affairs as something that was federal, meaning that the country itself had jurisdiction over Indian affairs, and it wasn't the individual provinces or individual communities that had decisions over things. And then, so that's where the Federation of Canada could then negotiate with tribes to purchase or to have or take over certain land that they had had previously. What was interesting is, of course, in 1867, there were no Indigenous people that were present in establishing this act. It was really just people who founded Canada were then decided to put this into place without consulting the people that had lived on the land at that time. So that's in 1876 with the development of the Indian Act, which was where, again, federal government was making decisions for the Indigenous people, and they were defining who was and was not Indigenous based on descent. So basically, Indigenous people became wards of the state without any autonomy, and they couldn't vote until the 1960s, had no ability to develop an economy on the land. So a lot of the reserves until this day are extremely impoverished, have no economy on them, have very limited housing and very limited resources as well. And there was also limited ability to move on and off reserve. So the idea was that if you wanted to leave your reserve to come to a big city, you actually had to give up your Indigenous status in order to have those basic human rights. So if somebody was moving from Northern Quebec into Montreal, that meant they had to give up their identity as an Indigenous individual to be able to live within Montreal. And then some of you may have heard the stories about residential schools already. So the residential schools were the idea that Indigenous children were taken from their homes and placed into more religious schools with the idea to assimilate Indigenous children to Canada. And so there was over 150,000 children that were placed in these residential schools. Thousands of them had actually unfortunately died. And this was up until 1996. So the last residential school closed in 1996, and I believe that was in Alberta. And now we often hear stories about where they're doing construction and uncover kind of mass burial graves from these residential schools. There was a large amount of abuse within the schools, both sexual and physical abuse. And so there's a lot of generational trauma. There are a lot of people that still are living to this day who had experienced residential schools. And that has been an extremely traumatic experience that has been passed down from generation to generation. So that brings us to the idea of the generational trauma. So you can see from the 1760s up until now, there's been so many things that have happened that have affected the Indigenous community in a negative way. And so that has caused this generational trauma where every generation since the 1760s or even before that has had some sort of trauma on them. And so it gets passed down. And so that causes an increased amount of stress, that causes a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of major long-term chronic effects as well. And so that's where, because of that, it's why we're seeing a lot more substance use, a lot more suicide, a lot more alcoholism, a lot of post-traumatic stress, and a lot of major chronic illnesses within the Indigenous community, just because there's so much stress level that's just from birth that has been going on. So as a result of all this generational trauma, as a result of residential schools and everything that's happened, you have a lot of problems. You have children that have grown up without parents for various reasons, suicide, mental health issues, substance use issues, just death from chronic illness. You have a lack of culture. So people have been removed from their culture and that cultural grounding and lack of community. You have, again, significant mental health problems. You have a lack of education. So the education system on reserves is extremely weak. So when someone decides to leave the reserve for a better opportunity now, their education is a lot lower. That makes it harder when they're coming to anywhere, Montreal, Toronto, to look for a better job. Makes it really hard. Because of the situation on a reserve, you have a lack of economic development. And then that leads to all these significant physical and mental health problems that have really shaped the way the Indigenous community is right now. So looking at what the urban Indigenous population is like, so this is the fastest growing population in Canada. And when you look at from 2001 to 2011, these are very old stats, and there's still kind of some more stats that are currently being done underway that haven't been published yet. There's been a 135% growth in specifically the Montreal population. When we look at how it's divided, so 38% of them are considered what we call status. So they have a status card, they're identified as Indigenous. 74% of them are non-status. So they may have been people who previously had their family members had left reserve, come to Montreal, lost their status, and then had children afterwards. And so that non-status identity has spread from generation to generation. What's nice now is that a lot of people are trying to get their status back. So by being able to prove their genealogy, they can get their status back. 66% of people are Métis, and Métis is the term for kind of like mixed. So someone who has one parent who is Indigenous with one parent who is not Indigenous. And then 30% of the communities are Inuit living in the cities. So Inuit are as a different group. So we have three different types of Indigenous communities in Canada. We have the First Nations, which are status Indigenous from different tribes. Then we have the Métis, which is a mix of those individuals who are mixed Indigenous, non-Indigenous. And then Inuit are specific tribes that are kind of looked more towards very north. So if you look at Nunavut, the territories, there's a lot more similarity with Inuit and kind of like Russian Indigenous, for example. And about 80% of all the Indigenous people in Canada live off reserve. The communities that are coming to Montreal, for example, are seeking more education, more employment opportunities, and they're often coming here alone. They speak a different language. So some of them speak English, very few of them speak French. Most of them speak a different Indigenous language. So they're coming here without having that base knowledge of English or French to get by. When they're on reserve, a health card is not something that's needed. They have their status card that gets them through their medical services, because on reserve, like I said before, that's a federal jurisdiction. So all their health services are through Canada. And then when they come to move to Montreal, that's all through Quebec and the province. And so that's a different health card. So they come here without a health card. That can be confusing. And then the health system and social services system is very confusing. So coming here alone without the ability to speak English or French and without a card, they're kind of stuck with like, well, what am I supposed to do? I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. So this is, again, very old information, but in 2012, we, the IHET, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a couple of minutes, did a health needs assessment. So we looked at about 100 individuals or Indigenous individuals living in Montreal. And looked at what were the needs of the community and what were things that were important to the community from a health perspective. So the majority of people that were interviewed rated their health as poor, and more than half of the people were dissatisfied with their health services. And we were actually able to name 64 different types of barriers to services, to access to care from this health needs assessment, but these were the ones that came up the most. So discrimination, language barriers, limited mental health services, barrier again, like I said, no provincial mental health Medicare card, lack of identification papers, prohibitive cost of care. So often if someone is coming to a clinic, they don't have their Medicare card with them, they're forced to pay because they don't have proof that they can be covered by the government. And then inadequate cultural safety. And the biggest ones are this discrimination and language barriers. So walking into an emergency room, for example, and automatically being identified as someone who's Indigenous and then being discriminated against by just assuming that someone who's Indigenous is using alcohol or drugs and is coming into the emergency room drunk is something that happens often. And so Indigenous individuals just don't feel comfortable coming to a clinic, coming to an emergency room where they know they're already going to be discriminated against. And so things get worse, their illnesses get really drastic and dire. And so they're coming in a lot sicker than they need to be because of that. So that's where the Indigenous Health Center of Geojage comes in. So this is a project that has been in development since 2008. To kind of give you a quick summary of how things happened in Montreal. So in 2008, there was a group called The Network, which is an organization of all the Indigenous organizations around a table in Montreal. And so in 2008, they were divided into seven different working groups. We were the health working group of the network. And from 2008 to 2012, we worked on this health needs assessment to identify what was needed in terms of health for the Indigenous community living in Montreal. And then from there, we've been working with government to kind of say like, hey, this is really important. When the health needs assessment came out in 2012, we really started advocating to the government to say like, hey, we really need a center. We really need somewhere where Indigenous individuals can access care in their own community in a way that they feel comfortable. And unfortunately, it took 15 years to really be able to show the government that this was something that was really important. The way healthcare works here is we have what's called CLSC. So there's these basically community access health centers, which encompass everyone. So everybody can access care within these centers. And the idea was, well, everybody should be able to access care. So it was hard to teach the government or to encourage the government to say, well, we need to think outside of the box. You have this community that doesn't feel comfortable accessing care in the same way that everybody else does. And so they need something different. And so getting the Quebec government to think outside the box was very hard. So that's why it took so long. It took a very traumatic event to actually really open the government's eyes. So in September 2020, there was the death of Joyce Eshequan, which again, something that you may have heard of. So Joyce Eshequan was a woman who was admitted to a hospital in Joliette, which is an area in Quebec. And she was coming in with like really bad pain. And they, the team had given her morphine, but they had given her too much morphine. And as opposed to kind of helping her out, she actually filmed herself at the last, in the last minutes of her death, and posted it to Facebook Live. And you could hear in the back of this video, nurses who were actually making fun of her while she lay there dying. And so this became a very huge event within the Montreal community in Quebec and in Canada as a whole, to say like, hey, this is not okay. We need better services for the Indigenous community. We need more cultural safety training so that this doesn't happen again. And so that's where finally funding came out that provided primary care services, led by community organizations. So that was what allowed us to establish the center as like a actual freestanding location. We got funding to set up the health center as a walk-in clinic. And then our doors opened August 9th, 2023. So it took us some time to find a location and get things rolling from that perspective. So this is where we're located. So this is the Queen Elizabeth Complex. It's a complex that's very old. It was built in 1894. And it actually is really cool because it's the whole premise is community health, but from a holistic aspect. So there is a separate walk-in clinic and family medicine clinic on the first floor. That's a residency clinic run by McGill University. But all the other floors are specialty services, homeopathic services. So things like massage therapy, physical therapy, psychotherapy, holistic medicines, acupuncture, things like that. So it's a really great location for us to be set in that is less hospital-like than some other places. So the services that we have, so right now we're a walk-in only clinic service. So I'm there Wednesday mornings, and that's I'm right now the only doctor. In January, we have another doctor that's coming on board. So I'm there Wednesday mornings. I see anywhere from 5 to 12 patients in that Wednesday morning time slot for really anything that they come in for. So some of it's general family medicine stuff, diabetes, hypertension. Some of it's more like wound care for patients that are that live on the street. I get navigators that bring in people from shelters to kind of take a look at ear infections. There's a lot of mental health need, drug use and things like that as well. We have an Indigenous health navigator. So the role of the navigator is to help navigate the system. So they will help bring someone to an appointment to get their blood work done, be there as the kind of the interpreter to kind of explain what treatment might be if they have to see a specialist and things get really complicated. We also have a traditional healer that'll be on site on Wednesday evenings, which some of you may have met if you were at Interota. He was actually the person that gave a talk about Indigenous care in on the Montreal side of Interota in 2014. So he's our traditional healer. So on Wednesday evenings, he meets with a couple of people and kind of focuses more on the traditional aspect of medicine as opposed to what I do with the Western medicine. And then we have a nurse on site too. We've built this as a really safe community space. So it's not really just a health center. It's there for people to come in, have a coffee, have a muffin, sit and talk, see their friends, see the community, and feel grounded within their community. Because right now there is no space in Montreal where the Indigenous community can feel like they have a space of their own. So the idea is eventually this won't be just a couple of rooms, but its own freestanding health center that has specialists, that has a lot of family doctors, that has more traditional healers, that's doing frequent traditional medicine and frequent cultural sessions to really have like a more of a cultural center within the Montreal community. And then, like I said, so future plans, we want to expand. For first, we want to expand the offer of walk-in services, so not just a half day a week, but hopefully it'll be at least 5 days a week. Eventually, we'll have pregnancy follow-ups as well, more mental health services and specialty services, and be able to build easy corridors of access to when we need a specialist really quick, that doesn't have to wait months to get an appointment. And then really teach current and future health professionals how to work with the Indigenous community and what the importance of cultural safety is. So just kind of going back on time, what cultural safety, so if I know some of you are doctors, some of you work in different fields where you may work with Indigenous people. And so it's the idea of like, what are things that you can do to kind of just improve and help the Indigenous communities wherever you are? Because the reality is a lot of Indigenous communities all over the world have had similar experiences to those in Canada, and still have that generational trauma as well. And so it's really important to just acknowledge past histories in order to improve the future. Listen to the person in front of you and respect the ideas that they have, and then to ask questions to the individual so that and kind of like show interest in what's happening with them, and then understanding your own country's history and how their impact has been on Indigenous people wherever you're from.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you so much for shedding light on the Indigenous community in Canada. I think people probably have heard of some of the news stories, but the fact that you're able to walk us through the history, I think it provides a lot more context. And there is this generational trauma, and you can see the ripple effects and the impact it has had on the community, even to this day. I'd love to hear more about what navigators do. You mentioned navigators, they go out. And so do they walk around the city and they reach out to people who they think require care and then bring them to the center?
So there's a mix of, sorry, I'm getting messages. Sorry. So there's different roles. So it depends on the organization they're with. So we have a group, there is a group called Médecins du Monde, or Doctors of the World, who does more kind of like community outreach, or more people living on the streets. So they do go out into the onto the street and see people there, and then they can sometimes bring them into the center if they need to. Here at the center, the navigator is really there more as a role to help someone get to where they need to go. So one thing that they could do is they kind of, but I don't want to call them social workers, but they act like social workers in some instances where they don't have a RAMQ card or a Medicare card. They'll help get them their Medicare card. They have specific forms to fill out because they're trying to get their driver's license or trying to find housing and things like that. That's what their role is there, to help them as another Indigenous individual, helping them feel comfortable in this whole process. If they have an appointment to go to, if they don't, maybe they don't speak English or French extremely well, so it's somebody there with them to help interpret what's going on, because often we like to speak in gigantic words and not make sense to anybody, whether if you speak English or French really well either. So imagine someone who can't speak the language at all, and then we're spewing a diagnosis of something that can be really scary out. That's where that navigator is there to really help them understand. And then, so those are kind of the big things. And then eventually our navigator will also go out into the community and say like, hey, I haven't seen this person in a while. I know they live around here. Let me go see if they're there and see if they need anything, or if we can bring them back to the center and do things like that.
That sounds like a very important role because, as you were saying, a lot of people are coming and they're alone. And I think when you're alone, it's hard to, it's difficult to navigate the system. You don't even know where you can go and get access to healthcare. And just, also not knowing the language very well or at all. So just to have somebody there who can guide you throughout the entire process can only be beneficial to their personal health. Now, you mentioned there's a traditional healer. So when people come in, like what percentage of them do you think are really looking for this like traditional care that they're more familiar with versus, as you say, like Western medicine? Is it really a mix or it just depends on the case?
It's really a mix. I think a lot of them are looking for both. So they're coming to the center, one, to have a doctor who understands cultural safety and just understands like Western medicine, but also to have that access to a traditional healer as well, so that whatever they're going through, they have access to both of those things to help them feel better.
Great, thanks. So I've already asked a few questions, but I'd love to open up the floor to our audience members' questions. So if anybody has a question, please feel free to raise your hand and I'll call on you to ask your question directly. Or if you like, you can share your questions in the chat and I can ask them to, yeah, on your behalf. While you're all pondering, I also wanted to learn more from you, Sean, about just your journey because you were mentioning that this health needs assessment started in 2008. It lasted 4 years. So, what really brought you towards committing to this and making sure that and focusing on providing access to healthcare to the Indigenous community? It seemed to have, there was some seed planted way back when. So, did something happen? What really inspired you or compelled you to pursue this?
So when I was doing my MPH, we did focus a lot on the Indigenous community in Quebec. And I actually had a project to do on mental health within the Indigenous community. And our initial project was to talk about just kind of like developing a mental health app. And then we ended up meeting the health working group to kind of see what's been going on within the Indigenous community and understand the network a little bit more. And it turned into this, well, instead of just mental health, like look at this health needs assessment and look, this is what we really need. And I just got really interested and I stayed involved. I was the coordinator for a little bit of the health working group and then kind of just continued on as a board member and eventually co-founder of the IHCT with them to establish it. So it's just been
Thank
like
you.
a kind of like passion that developed it out of nowhere, really. But yeah.
And I love the backstory too about how like the healer was also at Interota. I love that. That's fantastic. I would love to pass the mic over to Sam. Sam had a question.
Yeah, Sean, thank you, first of all, so much. This was great. As someone who is always trying to learn more and gain more knowledge, I was wondering if you had any suggestions for something like cultural safety trainings that any of us might be able to access, so that we can also begin to kind of do that work ourselves.
So one of them that I can put in the chat, there's a great one that's based out of British Columbia called the Sannyas Indigenous Training, and it's a like an online cultural safety training program. It's not that long at all, so at least it kind of gives you the basis of what kind of like what the understanding is and like how to be better in terms of cultural safety. Always look up. There's a bunch. Like there might be some all over the depending on that are a little bit less Canadian specific, and more U.S. specific or more European specific, depending where you are too. So I would encourage you to also just type in like cultural safety and wherever you're living right now, and see if there's something else that pops up. But the Sanyas one is great, and I know like a lot of people all over the world use it too.
Great, thank you.
No problem.
Sean, are there any plans to open up additional centers? Because I can imagine that the need is great and there's probably. Okay.
At the same time, so when we got funding, there were some other groups that got funding as well. So there's an Inuit specific health center that just opened a couple of weeks ago as well. And then there's another group called Native Montreal that also opened up a more like a family clinic. So their focus is more families and children, where ours is kind of more broad. We do focus, I guess, a little bit more on non-domiciled individuals and kind of the homeless community, but we're seeing everybody as well. And then there's one that's more Inuit specific. But and then the hope is that we're like already working together to help improve the community, but then to expand and either offer multiple sites or one larger center where everybody can access things.
Thank you. I'm just reading through the chat to see what other questions that have come through. Does the Indigenous community have the right to determine their own priorities and strategies for development, or is it still determined by the government? Maybe Raquel, you can elaborate.
Good question. So things have changed. So there are certain more economic things that can be done on reserve now, but it is still very limited. You can't, I think you can't, if I'm not mistaken, like you can't open a store, for example, but like you can, it can be more like planting or like agriculture can be on the land. And I believe there's certain like lottery, like casinos do open on the land as well. But there's certain like stores and things like that cannot be established on reserve. The reason being because on reserve, it's individuals living on reserve don't pay taxes, and so it's there's kind of that goes on. But it is a little bit complicated, and they're trying to change what can be developed. Hopefully, more things can be developed in the future so that the communities can develop their own community and do better as well.
Yeah, that was a great question. This one's really interesting. I think maybe you touched on it a little bit earlier when I asked about like the traditional healer, but are there some certain illnesses that maybe some individuals already believe that can be healed through traditional healing versus like Western medicine?
Yeah, so I think the mental health aspect of that is really important. So a lot of the mental health, kind of depression, anxiety, PTSD, the traditional part aspect is really important in that, in those regards, and feeling connected to the idea of connected to the land, connected to the animals, connected to the community, and then using certain plants to help with that healing process is extremely important. In terms of kind of more chronic illnesses that we see now, there's not they use it as an adjunct. It's not like believe that they, most people I've seen so far don't believe that just traditional healing will cure their diabetes, for example. But using the two in conjunction helps decrease stress and helps decrease that, like cortisol, that can increase your sugar levels and things like that too.
That makes sense. It's like, I mean, it's not completely the same, but you know, people doing like meditation or like breathing techniques or yoga, just yeah, any way to calm yourself down that can only help you in conjunction with additional care. Another question that came through, I know we had talked about navigators going out, but are there other ways that the center advertises its services to get the message out there to reach the people who do need to come in to take care of themselves?
So all the community organizations know that we're open, so that's where we get a lot of our referrals. So there's different organizations near us that will send their members to us on a weekly basis. They have their own navigators or their own social workers, and sometimes they come with them to help with the process. For example, there's the Native Friendship Center of Montreal that's not too far from us, and I'm in close contact. They have a nurse practitioner that works there, so almost on a weekly basis, she'll text me and say like, "Hey, I'm sending you someone over to do this," or then I'll be like, "Hey, I saw this person. They'll be at the center later tomorrow. Can you just check in on them?" And so we have that good relationship between all the organizations.
Yet has a question.
Perfect.
You're based in Montreal, but do you also see people that are especially coming into Montreal for to visit the center? Because I can imagine that it's spreading in the indigenous community that you're there for them and they can come over to have health care and other care obviously and especially travel to you.
Yeah, so we've had a couple of people that have come that have recently moved to Montreal. We don't have anybody as yet who've come kind of like from up north, for example, just to see us. There are different. There's already they do have, well, it's very limited. They do have access to doctors in kind of larger communities, and so thus far they haven't come down from the northern areas. But there are reserves right outside the island of Montreal, the area of Montreal, and people. So one of them is called Ganisetake, and they've come down to the center to see me for their care, for sure. Yeah. The other nice thing is, so there's this group called Uliviq, which is an Inuit organization, and so they're kind of like a housing group for Inuit individuals who've come from their community into Montreal for whatever kind of healthcare they need. But usually it's kind of more specialty services, but what we're trying to do is kind of work with them to say like if they have other things that it's not they don't necessarily need to see a specialist for, then like we can arrange transport and bring them from Uliviq, which is not too far from the center, into the health center, so I could see them as well.
Yeah. So the need is pretty big to have a center like you.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for your question, Yet. And yeah, thank you everybody for participating, for joining today, for this recording. If you're inspired to get involved and make a difference in your community, we invite you to learn more about Rotary International and the Rotary Club of Worldwide Impact. With that said, I'd love to turn it back to Sean for his final remarks.
Well, thanks everybody for listening today. I hope you learned a little bit about what cultural safety is and what the Indigenous community is like in Canada. And hopefully this brings something back to you guys wherever you're living now and how to approach cultural safety within your own countries. It was great to talk to you and great to see some familiar faces and meet some new ones. So hope to see you all soon.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you everyone for joining us today. Until next time.